We good?
All right.
Good afternoon. We're going to open up the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on General Government. Today is March 9th, 2015. We're going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 5035, the Department of Revenue. What do we need to know, sir?
Good afternoon, co-chairs and members of the subcommittee. Out on OLIS is information for the next 4 days of hearings for the Department of Revenue. So if we stay on schedule, those will be accurate. Otherwise, we'll move them around. One thing to note is that this is a large agency that has done a budget narrative before. You used to receive those in hard copy, but that's out there in addition to their presentations. And so that has a lot of very good information in it. And just as a final note, co-chairs and members of the subcommittee, the Joint Ways and Means co-chairs budget framework includes $1.8 million general fund for the CAFA funding short revenue shortfall. And there's also $1.9 million in unspecified reductions for the agency within the co-chairs framework. So thank you.
Perfect. All right. Mr. Director, the time is all yours. So it sounds like we have 4 days together.
That's right.
So what I'm going to ask is if you help me manage those 4 days. And so if we need to get going or get moving, you let us know, all right?
Fair enough. You want me to tell you to stop asking questions?
That's what I'm basically saying. You just say, you know, you've asked enough. I got a program to run here.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Jim Buholtz. I'm the director of your Department of Revenue. It is good to be here. I appreciate the opportunity to come and chat with you about our work. I'd like to go over my plan for the week, but I wanted to begin with a couple of introductory comments because I wanted to speak to the general state of the Department of Revenue in 2015. We're in a very different place than we were in 2013.
Senator Johnson.
If those comments were on time and under budget, it would be just lovely.
Okay. You might be able to work that in. As you know, I was appointed as director, confirmed as director in the middle of 2012. And I think everyone would acknowledge that I inherited an agency that was under some great stress. We were facing many significant challenges, but I think what you're going to hear over the next few days is that we're successfully transitioning into a better state than where we were just 2 years ago. Many of those challenges that I talked about at length in the 2013 session still remain. But for all, we've at least got a plan for how we go about proposing to solve them. Last session, I spoke to you about our aging IT infrastructure and how our core IT systems were nearing the end of their useful life. And thanks, in no small part, to the support of this committee, you'll hear this week that we're well on the road to solving that problem. Last session, I spoke to you about the growing problem of personal income tax refund fraud. You'll hear that we've done a better job this session or this biennium of stopping refund fraud, but you'll hear that it's still a problem for us, and in fact, it's growing exponentially. And so this week, we're going to present to you a couple of options for solving this or addressing this critical issue. In 2013, I also raised the problem of our growing accounts receivable. This is unquestionably still one of our biggest challenges at DOR, one that's going to take longer than one biennium to turn around. But this week, we're going to talk about how we're approaching it differently, and we'll talk about what we're doing to increase collections while we're working on installing the new state-of-the-art collection tools that you authorized for us. Lastly, those of you who were here in 2013 will remember that our workforce was also under great stress. When we get to the KPM portion of our presentation, I'll talk about the progress that we've made in re-engaging our staff. Because of all of the successes this biennium, this is the one I think I'm the most proud of. I don't want to give you the impression that with any of these challenges that we've arrived, but I do hope you'll agree with me by the end of the week that we're on a good path. So my plan for the week today, I'll give you an overview of the DOR, focusing on our major programs. I'll also report to you where we are on a special assignment that you gave us to raise revenue through an enforcement policy option package. And time permitting, I'll queue up the investment options for you that we'll be presenting to you this week. Tomorrow, we'll report on the what we've done on our initial conversion of our major tax systems and give you a heads up on what our plans are for further conversion during the 15-17 biennium. And then we'll also talk about personal income tax refund fraud and your options for helping us with that problem.
Wednesday is going to be about the income tax programs. We'll have our personal income tax and business tax administrators and one of our program managers come and talk to you about their progress and challenges, including that discussion of the accounts receivable. And then Thursday, our property tax administrator will come in and talk to you about that important program. We'll go over our key performance measures and leave time for DAS testimony and public testimony. Now, I do want to say that's the plan for the week, and like all plans, that's subject to change. We've tried to build it based on the things that we think that you're the most interested in, but as always, if you want to take us in a different direction, just let us know, and we'll morph. We want to have the conversation that you want us to have. So this is the Department of Revenue. This is our mission, vision, and values. We are, I would say, very aware of our unique role in state government at the Department of Revenue. When I talk to people about the Department of Revenue, I'll often say that we are simultaneously the least important agency in state government and the most important agency in state government. We're the least important because we don't deliver direct services, and that's what state government really is all about, is the delivery of those services. But we're the most important because without us, nobody else does either. You can see our vision there, and that is what has been driving our recent transformation at the Department of Revenue, and you can see the values that drive the decisions that we make. This slide graphically shows the program organization of the agency, and it also shows the way that the agency is collectively led. It's a familiar slide in this presentation. We've shown it before in several bienniums. But what I wanted to say about this is that there has been almost complete turnover in that leadership team since I took over as director. But virtually all of that was in the first year. Over the last 2 years, we've really been very stable. The only real difference between this biennium and last biennium when I came and spoke to you is that we've combined the leadership of the Administrative Services Division and the IT Services area under Terrence Woods, who some of you met last time. These are our major tax programs. At the Department of Revenue, we administer many programs and services, but the big three are the income tax, the property tax, and the tobacco taxes. I'm going to focus most of my comments today on these three, and at the end of the day, I'll list a slide that's got some of the other programs and services that we perform at DOR. Just as a reminder, DOR is responsible for administering most of the programs that bring in your general fund. The largest by far is the personal income tax, and you can see that brings in nearly $14 billion of the $16 billion in total general fund revenues. Next is the corporate income tax, and tobacco brings in about $130 million to your general fund. The actual tobacco programs bring in a little bit more than $500 million, but you'll see when we get to that part of the presentation that a large part of the tobacco revenues are dedicated to non-general fund programs. We do collect some of that other slice, that $699 million, most notably court fines and assessment and amusement device tax. For the income tax programs, this is what we affectionately refer to as our cradle-to-grave programs because we have administration responsibility for 100% of the administration of the income tax program. We begin by giving taxpayers the forms and instructions that they need to comply, and we help them to understand their obligations and help them to understand the tools that they have in order to comply. Assistance in education takes many forms for us. We have numerous forms and publications that we refresh every year. We have a website that we continue to develop applications to help taxpayers help themselves. And I think over the next 2 years, you're going to see quite a bit of movement where we are expanding that website greatly as we take advantage of some of the increased functionality that the GenTax program has. GenTax is the system, the personal income tax system or tax system that we're in the midst of converting to. We have a small call center at the agency that answers one-on-one questions from taxpayers. And we also have what's known as an interactive voice response system, where we load on the most frequently asked questions to try to funnel those questions off onto an automated process and free up the staff time for the other calls that can't be taken care of on that in that way. We have the big building in Salem, and then we also have other offices around the state. In processing, we expect to process just under 2 million tax returns this year. And as of this morning, I looked, and we're a little bit more than a third of the way there, which is really very typical for this time of the year. Our big crunch is going to be next month, obviously. We also receive amended and past due returns that we process. And last biennium, we broke the 80% barrier with electronically filed returns. We're now at 82.5%, and that continues to rise. We have another 10% in what we call 2D barcode. And 2D barcode is, it's a paper return. We require the software vendors that produce paper returns to include this 2D barcode on the top of the return. And if you're not familiar with a 2D barcode, you can look on the back of your driver's license and see one. That the back of the driver's license, that contains all of the information that's in the driver's license. And likewise, this 2D barcode for us contains all of the information that's in that tax return. And we can just shoot it with a wand, and then from that point, we treat it just like an electronically filed return. It's much cheaper for us to do it that way than to deal with the straight paper, and it's been a real help to us. So 82.5% electronic filing, 10% 2D barcode, and another 7.5%, which is just straight paper.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering, since you've implemented all these different techniques to be more efficient and effective, how much are you saving for the taxpayers there?
Mr. Chair, Representative Comp, I don't have a dollar figure for you.
Roughly.
Well, we'd have to go back, I think. I don't have any that on the top of my head. What I will say is this. If you were to go back some 20 years ago when we first started electronically filing, the Department of Revenue was about 1,000 people. We're most of the expenses that we incur are in our staff, mm-hmm. right? And we were about 1,000 people. And if you look at us today, we're about 1,000 people. But over the years, you have given us various enforcement packages, so auditors and collectors. And if you were to look at that graphically, you would see the infrastructure of the Department of Revenue going down over time. And the difference that makes up that 1,000 people is the enforcement packages. So we're able to add more enforcement staff. You were able to invest in us in that manner, I think at least in part because of the increased efficiencies because of electronic filing.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Processing includes verifying the correct computation of tax, and that includes fixing anything on the face of the return that needs to be fixed. So this would be math errors, exemption credit mismatches. Federal tax subtraction is capped at $6,350. That's the most anybody can subtract, and sometimes taxpayers will put their entire tax liability down, and so we'll adjust that on the face of the return. Last year, we made $27 million in net adjustments in this particular area. And I say net adjustments because the door swings both ways. We increased billings by $55 million and increased refunds by $28 million. So taxpayers oftentimes make mistakes that cost them money, too. And if we can catch those in the processing of the return, then we'll correct that and increase their refund. To banking, we bank through two primary sources, really. The first is, and by far the largest, is the electronic funds transfer. That's where employers submit the withholding that they withheld from taxpayer, or excuse me, yes, from taxpayer wages. But we still get a lot of manual, a lot of paper checks in the banking area. We're still fairly manual, particularly in the payment of the personal income tax, but although that number is shrinking through the years. Enforcement includes both auditing and filing enforcement. In auditing, we spend some time with the taxpayer and try to verify the items on their return. Filing enforcement is just that. Those are taxpayers that we think ought to be filing with us that aren't. Yeah, we work with them and help them out.
Talk to us about the partnership the Oregon Department of Revenue would have with the Internal Revenue Service in terms of auditing. If I remember correctly from a previous conversation, information collected from the IRS is forwarded to the state of Oregon. Do we reciprocate back?
Mr. Chair, yes, we do. We have a reciprocal agreement, like you said, with the Internal Revenue Service, where they send us the results of all of their audits, and we send them the results of all of our audits. And as far back as I can remember, when I first started 33 years ago, that was one of the first things they put me on as an income tax auditor.
I think that's powerful to have that reciprocal arrangement, so that way information is being shared both ways.
It is, although I have to tell you that the federal government hasn't been keeping up on their end of the bargain as much as they have in the past, and it's primarily because of the reduction that they've taken in their budget. Uh-huh. You go back a couple of years ago, their yearly budget was over $13 billion. Now it's under $11 billion. And they're like us. If you get a reduction in your budget, you have to process 100% of the returns you get in. You have to process 100% of the checks you get in. The only real kind of discretionary area you have is in the enforcement. And so their enforcement has dropped off the table for us. And so that's not as lucrative as it has been in past years. We're hopeful that'll pick back up. Collecting. We have a substantial collection function at DOR where we collect past due debt, and that would be self-assessed debt, so the taxpayers that file returns and didn't pay the full amount that they owe, they say, I owe this, please work with me. We work with them to get that. We collect the audit adjustments that we make, and we also collect the filing enforcement adjustments that we make. This biennium, the income tax programs are expected to bring in about $14.8 billion, which is 94% of your general fund. This slide underscores an important point about our work. Veterans of this committee will probably recognize this slide. It illustrates the source of the revenues for the personal income tax. The vast majority of the revenues that come in for personal income tax come in through three sources. The first is withholding by employers, so that's employees correctly telling the employer how much to withhold from their checks and the employer remitting it to us. Quarterly estimated payments. These would be typically for taxpayers that don't have withholding. Maybe they're in a small business or they've sold some property and they owe additional amount. They'll send in the amounts quarterly to us, similar to withholding. And then lastly, payments with returns. And this is where taxpayers calculate the amount of tax that they owe and then square up at the end of the year. And out of all of the revenues that we receive in the personal income tax program, 90% of those come in through those three voluntarily paid sources. Only about 3% of the revenues come in through the Department of Revenue's direct enforcement efforts. In 2013, I reported to you that was newly up from 2%. I've been here for 30 years, and we've always talked in terms of the 2%, 98%, but it's up to 3%. I think in part it's because we're doing a better job, but I think as much as anything, it's a reflection that we're still dealing with the aftermath of the Great Recession.
Senator Whitson.
Thank you, Chair. How much of that 3% is initiated by the Oregon Department of Revenue, and how much of it is initiated by the under federal income tax, that sort of thing? I mean, is this 3% something you go out and find, or are you following along the federal?
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, I was looking at the numbers for the federal revenue agent reports, the audits that they did that we piggyback and bill, which would go into that 3% column, and it was about $20 million. Let me get the actual number for you. It's most of that number is the Department of Revenue's direct enforcement efforts. And, but you're right, there is a chunk that was from the federal audit reports. And we can get that number for you. So some of that 97% absolutely is influenced by the enforcement work. In other words, the reason that 97% is as high as it is because the taxpayers know that we're out doing those direct enforcement efforts. But the vast majority of the income tax revenues do come in voluntarily. And that's why we place such a high priority on education and assistance in trying to move people to complying on their own initiative. And that's kind of what this slide is intended to illustrate for you. We do everything that we can to move people from the red side of the slide, which is much more expensive for us to administer, to the blue side. It's much more expensive for the taxpayer, too, on the right side. And so to the extent that we can help them get them into the blue side, then it's better for them as well. And so cheaper for both the taxpayer and for us. And that's income tax. I move to property tax. Property tax is a very important program at the local level. The state doesn't impose a property tax, although the Constitution allows it. The department functions in the property tax are designed to support the work that the county assessors and tax collectors do and to ensure consistency and uniformity across counties. We are responsible for valuing complex properties. And I'm speaking here of the utility and transportation properties. This would be communication property, railroads, airlines, electric companies, other energy companies like gas companies. And that portion of the role is approximately $20 billion in value. So that's value. That's not tax, but the $20 billion in value. We take our responsibility is just to do the valuation, and then we take those values and we ship them to the county assessors who incorporate them into their tax rolls. We're also responsible for valuing industrial properties.
I have a question here, Senator Johnson.
Remind me, Mr. Buchholz, if you would, what's the pathway for an appeal? You all are doing the valuation at a considerable distance, and then you're passing that information on to the assessors, and they then put it into their local process. What happens if a taxpayer disputes your valuation? What mechanism do they have to bring that to an adjudicatory body?
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, for the centrally assessed properties, the first level of appeal is what's known as director's review. And so by sometime in the middle of June, we get the proposed values out to the taxpayers, and then they have an opportunity to come and chat with me about them. And then I sometimes adjust the values, sometimes I sustain the values. If they don't like my determination in that, then they have an opportunity to go to tax court. I think they get to go to magistrate first and then to tax court after that, and then the Supreme Court after that.
Thank you.
So we are also responsible for valuing large industrial properties. These are industrial properties with a value of $1 million or more. These would be your wood products companies, electronics companies, food processing companies, et cetera. And that portion of the role had a collective value of about $25 billion last year.
So let me ask a question on that. Do we have expertise within our department to go out and value Intel in Hillsborough? How do we do that? Do we contract that out, or do we have folks with that level of understanding?
Mr. Chair, we do. Although you'll see when we get to that portion of the presentation, we make it harder on ourselves because the process is so manual. There's a lot of paper involved, a lot of individual spreadsheets. And thank you for the the queue up, but there is software out there, commercial software, that is, it's called, was CAMA. Now you're going to kick me for using an acronym, and we use it. It's a mass appraisal, mass appraisal software that does this in an automated fashion. And so what we'll be proposing is something that will help us in that regard. But we do have people that value intel every year. We rely on the information that the company gives us, but that's part of the process.
Mm-hmm. Senator Whitson.
Thank you. Mr. Buchholz, I want to focus on the other end of the spectrum. Very few businesses have property values of less than $1 million anymore. $1 million isn't that much money. So when has the department, if ever, adjusted that central assessment upwards to reflect the loss of value of the dollar?
Well, Mr. Chair, that $1 million threshold, or Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, that $1 million threshold defines the responsibility for who values the property. Yes. If it's $1 million or more, the Department of Revenue values it and sends the values back to the county assessor to incorporate into the roll. If it's below $1 million, then the county values it, and the county sends the tax statement to the taxpayer. So everybody below $1 million and above $1 million is assessed.
No, I follow up. I appreciate that. Perhaps I didn't make myself clear. How long has that $1 million threshold been in place? Has it ever been adjusted? And has it ever been adjusted for the value of the dollar? Because my understanding that when a central assessment has quite a different characteristic than a local assessment sometimes.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, the $1 million threshold came in 1989. Prior to 1989, the Department of Revenue was valuing properties of $5 million or more. Mm-hmm. And we took on the responsibility for valuing the $1 million to $5 million properties in exchange for the CAFA revenues, for 10% of the CAFA revenues, and took them off the county's workload. But that $1 million threshold has been in place since 1989, and it's not indexed.
Thank you.
So between central assessment and industrial property, the large industrials, Department of Revenue is responsible for about $1 billion of that $11.3 billion in property tax revenues. The rest of it comes from the counties. Mapping is very important to the property tax system. It visually identifies the tax base. It's more important for property tax to do that visual identification, because otherwise you'd be relying on the legal descriptions. I don't know if you've ever read a deed and saw the legal description. It's impossible to parse. And so what the cartographers do is they'll actually map it, and you can see it visually. And what this ensures is that no taxpayer is assessed on more than what their property is, and nobody, there are no slivers or no gaps. Nothing is missing. Our role in mapping is to set statewide standards, and we also do contract work for the small counties, some of the small counties. Nine of the 36 counties don't have enough work on their own to hire their own cartographer, and so they contract with us to do that work for them, and they pay us for that. We are also working to transform the mapping system from paper to completely digital. To the county administration oversight, we have responsibility for oversight over the entire system of property taxation in Oregon. We provide centralized support for the 132 exemptions and special assessments out there. We also
I probably asked you this question 2 years ago, and I probably have forgotten, which I shouldn't have, but 132 exemptions and special assessments. Could you give us some examples of those?
Oh, my goodness.
If you want to give it back to us on that, that's fine, Mr. Buchholz, but 132 strikes me as a pretty large number, and one of the things we're always looking at is ways to simplify things and clean things up and consolidate things, so this may be an area we should look at to simplify. So it doesn't have to be an instant answer, but it's an interesting question. It may not be possible.
No, I believe the Legislative Revenue Office compiles this and has a book that they hand out on a biannual basis.
Oh, is that in just this tax expenditures book?
Yes.
Oh, well, then I'll look. I've got my tax expenditures book. I'll go look there.
It's fascinating. You go through and you can see them all. Wow. And it'll show the history with each one, a description, et cetera.
And Mr. Chair, if I may, because our research section will kill me if I don't, that's not actually legislative revenue that does that.
It's
that's
you
the
folks.
Department of Revenue.
I right. stand corrected. All right.
Thank you. Thank you. And I will go back and look at that book. And if I have questions about it, I'll come back to you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, yes, I'm glad that you found good reading material while you're waiting at wrestling matches.
That's right. Truth be told, that's not where I was reading it.
I understand.
Hey, Mr. Chair, we also have a part of the Department of Revenue where we are responsible for reviewing and blessing the county valuation methodology. So each year, the counties send in their work to us and ask us to take a look at it and identify whether we believe that it's correct. This allows taxpayers to be treated consistently from county to county, and we also provide a good deal of education and assistance directly to the counties to help them in their work. The forest land valuation piece, our role in forest land
Mr.
valuation.
Chair. Yes, Senator Johnson.
Is there a mechanism in place so that you're not doing the work of the counties that it's somewhat ecumenical, that you don't have counties that are just saying we're not going to invest in our process here, we'll get revenue to take that up? Is there a safeguard?
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, the only real safeguard is us working with the counties to make sure that we're not doing their work. I would say that if you went back 10 years ago in the Department of Revenue, there were several counties that were treating us more or less like a sixth man, where they would have some particular issue, they'd call us in, and we'd be doing that work on their behalf, where all of the other counties were providing for that particular work, whatever it might be, on their own. There's a check, kind of a natural check in the system, in that if we are helping an individual county with work that they ought to be doing themselves, then the other counties call us on it, because that means there's not resource available to them for doing their work. But I would say that our property tax administrator, Mark Kinslow, whom you'll get a chance to meet on Thursday, has done a tremendous job of pulling that back and making sure that the counties are doing what they ought to be doing and make sure the Department of Revenue is doing what we ought to be doing.
Mr. Chair, just to make sure that nobody out there in county land is taking offense at my question, I am all for the department helping counties help themselves, not supplanting your work product. You've answered my question very well. Thank you.
So to forest land valuation, our role in forest land valuation is to set the values for forest land based upon productivity class. And then we give those values to the county assessors who take those values and incorporate them into the actual parcels to send out the tax bills to those owners. Overall, the property tax is expected to generate just a little bit more than $11 billion in 13-15. And unlike the income tax, like I said, where we do it all, this is a partnership between the counties and the Department of Revenue. Counties are responsible for the boots-on-the-ground administration of the property tax system, and we're responsible for the overall supervision of the system and for those things that make the most sense to do on a centralized basis, like the valuation of those large properties. I included one stacked bar chart in the presentation because I know that Senator Steiner Hayward is a big fan of these.
Oh, yeah, totally.
This illustrates the an overlooked point, an often overlooked point about the property tax. It's intended to show the partnership in service delivery between the counties and the state in the property tax. And now I'm going to ask you to blur your eyes a little bit. Don't look at the numbers so much, because the numbers are based on projections, and they're also based upon recent spending patterns. And so I can almost guarantee that the numbers will change by the time the session is over. But it gives you an order of magnitude about the importance of the property tax to the services that we're really interested in at the state level. Mm-hmm. At the state level, we're interested in education, public safety, mm-hmm. and human services, mm-hmm. right? And oftentimes, we'll talk about where the property tax dollars go, and we'll talk about in terms of so much goes to counties, and so much goes to cities, and so much goes to special districts, but that doesn't really tell the story. The real story is that the counties and the cities and the special districts are providing some of those big blocks of services, those same big blocks of services that we're really interested in at the general fund level. And so property tax is an important program to Oregonians. So I'll move to tobacco. In total, the cigarette tax and other tobacco products tax will generate a little bit more than $500 million this biennium. You can see that most of the dollars are dedicated to specific purposes. So the Oregon Health Plan, smoking cessation programs, and cities and counties, et cetera. But about one quarter of the revenues go into the general fund. Our administration of tobacco is a little bit different than the income tax. For cigarettes, we sell the stamps that are affixed to the packs. And so we sell to wholesalers and distributors who apply the stamps, and that's a visual representation that the tax has been paid. We have an enforcement piece where we do inspections to make sure that the tax has been paid. We'll look for those stamps and make sure that the stamps haven't expired. The other tobacco products portion of this would be cigars, chew, snuff, works a little bit more like the income tax. You can imagine that it might be a little hard to put a stamp on chew, and so we don't. We ask wholesalers to file returns, much like an income tax, and they pay a tax that's based primarily on the weight of the product. And then we have an audit function that works like the income tax to verify the accuracy.
Let me ask a question on that. Is the stamp still the most efficient way to administer this program? Are other states still using a tobacco stamp?
Mr. Chair, every state that has a cigarette tax, I think, uses that stamp. I don't know of a state that doesn't. I can check with our...
I wouldn't do that. I'm just trying to figure out, is that still the most efficient way to administer, to enforce that activity?
Mr. Chair, as far as I know, it is.
It is, okay. All right.
Follow up on that, Mr. Chair. 10 years ago, I was privileged to sit on revenue, and we got to go and see the OLCC building and all the nice, wonderful beverages we can drink. And the next place we went to was where they did the cigarette stamps. Mm-hmm. 10 years ago, they were doing those by hand. Don't tell me they're still doing them by hand.
Mr. Chair, Representative Comp, maybe a few small distributors might do it by hand. I don't know, but...
The
vast majority of these are done by machine. And there's a machine that actually, the cartons roll down. It opens up the carton, affixes the stamp, and seals the carton back up.
Okay, that wasn't the way it was 10 years ago. But I was just like, you're doing what?
Yeah.
Yeah, affixing the stamp on the cigarette packs. Yeah, interesting.
We've come a long way.
So let me ask one more question on that. I'm just trying to create the visual. So is that stamp... when it's done through mechanical means, is that done at the processing plant itself, the tobacco processing plant, or is it done once the tobacco comes into Oregon?
Mr. Chair, I think it depends on the distributor or the wholesaler. I think some of them do it prior to sending it into Oregon. I think some of them don't do it until it actually comes into Oregon.
Interesting. Okay. Thank you.
We have agreements with 8 of the Oregon tribes. Tribes have the ability, or they have the authority, to sell untaxed cigarettes to their tribal members. And that creates an enforcement problem for us at the Department of Revenue. And so we have, or the tribes have agreed to sell cigarettes that the tax has been paid on, and then we rebate that to them. And it's been a tremendous help to us, and the cooperation from the tribes has been tremendous as well. And I wanted to report to you that this year, just this last fall, we successfully negotiated the first other tobacco products agreement with the Coos, Umpqua, Lower Siuslaw tribe, and we're hopeful that that will become the model that we'll use for the other tribes too. In fact, some of the other tribes have already come calling to us saying that they want to have that same agreement with us.
Senator Whitsitt.
Thank you. Just out of curiosity, is there how much money is returned to the tribes in lieu of their cigarette taxes and other tobacco taxes, and is there any control over what that money is spent for?
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, I'll have to get the dollar amounts for you. I don't have those. But no, the money is the tribes.
Thank you.
Can I ask a question, Mr. Chair?
Madam Co-Chair.
Do you have any sense? Oregon is one of only 8 states in the union that doesn't require tobacco retailers to be licensed, leaving aside tribal, just in the state. Do you have any sense that that presents any problems in enforcement on the tax side? I know it presents problems on the sales to minors side, but do you have any sense that you're limited in that way, or do you think that the distributors are doing a good enough job?
Mr. Chair, Senator Sarah Hayward, I don't know of any problems that we've had. I think that we've got pretty good compliance in the tobacco tax program. I don't know that there's been a particular problem with it. I can check with the – nobody's told me about
okay.
it anyway.
Okay, that's sufficient. So thank you very much. Just curious.
And these are just some of the other taxes and services that the Department of Revenue administers. I promised the slide to you, and now I've delivered. This is the Department of Revenue strategic plan structure. This page and the next illustrate for you the framework of the overall Department of Revenue strategic plan. It starts with our mission, our vision, and our values, but the key for the programs are the 5 outcome areas that we've identified. 3 of those go to the business, so enforcement, voluntary compliance, and equity and uniformity go to the business. 1 goes to the taxpayer, and 1 goes to the customer. The divisions are responsible for then identifying the overall strategies that impact the outcomes. And then the next layer down shows how the sections take the agency framework and apply it to their business. The sections at the program and unit level identify the program-specific strategies and the initiatives that drive to the outcomes. And if you're interested in a little bit more detail on this, this is just the framework that I've got on this slide, but page 12 to 14 in your booklet has a sample of one of our area strategic plans, so you can look at that. This is our report card on the tax compliance policy option package that you gave us this last time. As part of our 13-15 budget, you gave us additional resources for a couple of special projects. The first one, the main one, was that the core system replacement project, which we'll talk about in detail tomorrow. But the other one was to clean up our accounts receivable and to generate a few extra dollars for your general fund. And the first part here talks about that second half there. You gave us $3.8 million in exchange for a promise to deliver to you $33.1 million. And you can see that we've collected about 88% of that goal through the first 3 quarters of the biennium, so we're on track.
Yeah, that's well done.
That's really well done. Mm-hmm. That's lovely to see. Nicely done.
Thank you. The second part of that policy option package.
Before we go on, while those are really very good numbers, and I commend you for the progress you've made, the arrearages are still staggering. And I don't want us to just pass over that, congratulating you for helping to clean up Dodge, but could you talk about that a little bit and how aged they are and why it is that we seem to still be struggling with getting some of that policed up in a more timely way? And I ask for two reasons. First of all, I think that the committee ought to be aware of it. And secondly, it can't help but have a chilling effect on responsible taxpayers if there are no consequences for the scoff laws.
Yeah, fair enough. Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, our income tax administrators are going to talk at length about the accounts receivable on Wednesday. So I'll leave that piece to them. But the tax gap is the bane of all tax administrators across the country, right? And it's something that frustrates all of us. There's a substantial tax gap, and when we're all done implementing the system and we're using the state-of-the-art tools that you've given us, there still will be a substantial tax gap. I think part of the problem is the structure of the tax itself. It's a personal income tax. It relies on voluntary compliance. And it's not voluntary compliance from the standpoint that it's voluntary whether you comply with it or not. We rely on taxpayers voluntarily telling us what they owe. And then we have a checking mechanism behind it. In order to completely close the gap, well, let me talk about it in this way. I think we're a little bit ahead of schedule, so I can get into it in a little bit more depth. We were asked to do an estimate of the tax gap for Oregon about 5-6 years ago. And we estimated that the tax gap was about $1.2 billion for a single year, so a substantial number. But we didn't do a study ourselves. What we did was we piggybacked the study that the Internal Revenue Service did. The Internal Revenue Service did a study back in 2001. They spent $200 million on this study. And so they spent the equivalent of the department's biennial budget on this study. And we took that study, and what they did was they estimated non-compliance percentages based on income types. So for wages, you might imagine that wages, because of the high degree of third-party reporting, was very small. And it was like 1.3%, the tax gap. On the other hand, non-farm proprietor income was somewhere north of 50%. And so what they're saying here is that businesses are skimming before they even report to us. This is the way they did that. They estimated, or what they called a detection controlled estimation process, and this is just a fancy term for a fudge factor. And what they did was they audited a certain number of returns from soup to nuts, from every single line on the return in depth. They audited, and they took the results of that audit and they applied this percentage to it to come up with the real understatement. So, and the understatement, or the detection controlled estimation, was between 3.3 and 4.2. And so what that means is if they found $100, they estimated the true understatement to be $330 to $420. So what this says is that you could assign every single Oregonian their own personal auditor, and we could audit every single Oregonian, and when it's all said and done, we'd find that $100, but we'd miss the $230 to $330 that remained because of the ability for taxpayers to not report all of their income. Now, there are audit techniques that we can use to detect that, but they're very expensive to do. The ROI doesn't pencil out on them. I was doing them 30 years ago as an auditor. We called them Tennessee T's because you'd do a T account, and you'd put the reported receipts on one side, and you'd put the reported and observed expenses on the other, And the difference between the two, if there was a difference, was deemed to be unreported income. Mm-hmm. They're very difficult to do. Not everybody has the expertise to do it. They're difficult and time-consuming to defend on appeal, and we get near 100% appeal rate on these. But they're important for us to do some. Because we want to establish a presence, but we don't have the ability to audit everybody in that manner. What we're hopeful, or what we know, is that the first layer of changing this for us is the work that you've authorized for the system. The part of what you authorize with the new system is a data warehouse, and that's going to allow us the ability to match. And the next layer, once we get the system in place, the next layer will be what's known as predictive analytics, where we're able to take information from a couple of different tax years and say, boy, this doesn't make sense. If a taxpayer spent this much in this raw material for their final product, that says that they ought to have this much in gross receipts. But we just don't have the ability to do that now on the one-off system that we've got with our current programs. We're working on it. It's in the forefront of our minds, but we just haven't arrived yet.
Senator Whitson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You say that income tax is voluntary, and certainly people assess themselves, but it's not a criminal act to not pay reported taxes, and it's certainly not a criminal act to take any credits or deductions or exclusions or whatever is available by law, maybe to push the envelope. But it's my understanding it is a criminal act to not report reportable income, and which makes it a little less involuntary in my mind.
Right.
So I would hope that that these new tools will give you a better opportunity to identify those people who are not reporting their income.
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, you're right, and I apologize if I misspoke on that or wasn't clear. Voluntary compliance doesn't mean it's voluntary whether you pay it. It's voluntary. We rely on the taxpayer voluntarily telling us how much they owe, and then we work from it. The income tax is the exact opposite of the property tax. The income tax, the taxpayer assesses themselves, and the government checks it in the audit process. In the property tax, it's the exact opposite. The government assesses the taxpayer, and the taxpayer has the check in the appeal process. And that's why there's such a higher percentage of the property tax that's paid than the income tax. But it's also more expensive to administer. So, accounts receivable. This reports on the work that we did to clean up uncollectible debt. I told you last time that it had been several years since we had taken the time to write off and cancel bad debt. And you gave us resources and direction to do just that. And this is an important project for us because time spent working on uncollectible debt is time that we're not spending working on collectible debt. So it's important for us to do this work. Just so you know, write-off moves debt out of active work queues, but it remains collectible. But there's a requirement on us to go back at least yearly and reevaluate whether or not it still ought to remain on the write-off status. Cancellation eliminates the debt entirely. And incidentally, an automated accounts receivable cleanup is something that the new system does very well. And we should never get as far behind on this as we had. This is the queue up.
Representative Dickinson.
Thank you. I'd like to ask a question about the previous slide. I appreciate the difference between write-off, which is really just a temporary thing. Mm-hmm. I was kind of worried about the use of that term until you explained it remains collectible. It's just written off the current years in a way. But cancellation, I guess I'm a little bit concerned that legally we're giving up on something that might still be collectible, but just far in the future. What if someone has moved out of state for quite a while and they move back and they do have assets. Have we given up our ability to collect what was owed to us in the previous decade?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nathanson, if it's canceled, yes, we have given that up. But I think if you look at the criteria for what kinds of debts we canceled, this is no assets located in 3 years, no payments received in 7 years, no correspondence received in 3 years, and it's been assigned to a field agent for more than a year. And in most cases, if not all cases, we've also given a private collection firm a crack at collecting this debt. And in that time, in 7 years, no payment has been received on it. And so we can leave this on our books, but then that requires us to do some more work on it. And what we're saying and what the law allows us to do is to remove it from the books and say, look, just like any business, all businesses write off bad debts. And that's what this is. It's saying, look, this isn't collectible. I'm not going to spend any more time or resource chasing after something that just doesn't have an opportunity to be collected.
Yeah, please follow up, and then we'll go to Representative Hurd.
Thank you. I remain concerned about this. I understand that you said this is what the law allows you to do, but we write the law here, and sometimes we change it.
Yes, you do.
I don't know how often this might happen, but what if there's an individual with deep pockets and successfully using attorneys or accountants to figure out how to move money around, keep us from knowing about it, moves out of state for 8 years or 15 years? There really are assets that are discoverable. It seems like it would be useful for us to have something between write-off and permanent forever cancellation. I have no idea whether this might happen once a century or 1,000 times. But I'm concerned that we're saying, oh, we recognize that you have a lot of money available, but no thanks, we don't need it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nathanson, you're absolutely right. You are in control of the parameters that we look at for write-off, and if you decided that this was too liberal of a standard for us, then you absolutely can rewrite that for us. What I would hope, at least from an administration standpoint, is that whatever that threshold happens to be, it strikes that balance between us spending resource on something that may not be collectible and the ability to maybe get that person that happens to win the lottery in the eighth year.
And one brief follow-up.
Yep, please.
Thank you for that response. I agree absolutely. The cost benefit wouldn't be worth it if we were still sending someone out to track down all those track down all that stuff every year. But with so much automation and technology available to us now, it seems like it might be pretty simple to have an automated way of when names, social security numbers, whatever pop up as back in Oregon, whether it's because of a driver's license or building a new home. It seems like we could figure out a way of saying, no, we're not asking you to go investigate every year, but to leave it still collectible in case a name turns up in an automated, in just a routine automated search.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nathanson, I'd be happy to have a chat with you about this. I'd probably want to bring somebody that's a little bit closer to the program and understands it a little bit better than I, but I'd be happy to talk to you about
thank
it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Hurd.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the Mr. Director, if you've already said it, forgive me for asking again, but the 2,836 liabilities, what period of time did it take to collect that amount of liabilities? Is that 1 year, 10 years?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hurd, it depends on the program. Hmm. For some of our programs, it was a little bit more than 3 years. because nothing could be written off if it wasn't at least 3 years old.
Okay.
There were some programs where I think I saw there were debts that were 12 to 15 years old. And they, so it really depends on the program.
Okay. Follow up?
Yeah.
Thank you. Do you guys have any data, or could you get us some data that would show us what the average cost per case is as far as going out there and trying to recover these liabilities? I'd be very interested in that. Because that number right there works out to about $1,516 per liability.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hurd, we can certainly try. We've got folks back home listening, and so we can see if we can't put something together on that.
One more follow-up. So, yeah, I mean, I'm a business guy. I've had people default on debt that they owed me, and at a certain point, they just don't become worth pursuing anymore. And I did sick the dogs on them, so to speak, with the collections agency and just let them deal with it. But yeah, to me, it's about the risk reward.
Sure.
Plus, I don't know, me personally, I just don't really want to see the state just be this hound that for 20 or 30 years pursues somebody over a liability, however small or big it may be. At some point, I think you have to just let it go.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hurd, it's about striking that balance.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
We're a tax administration agency. We're all about people complying,
and
we want people to comply. And part of the reason why some of these got so old is because we couldn't let them go, or we had a difficult time letting them go, even though if we were spending time and resource on it, it was actually costing the state money to maintain that attitude.
Thank you.
The one struggle I still have, and I've shared this forever, is I wish there was a way to have some form of public database system to where other creditors could know which folks still owe the state of Oregon money. And I don't know if that's possible, but and I'll never forget Senator Johnson saying this years ago, that it seems inappropriate that people can owe the state of Oregon money but go down to Sears and get credit for their washing machine.
Mm-hmm.
And at some point in time, it would just seem like there ought to be a mechanism to where people who are looking to extend credit to people who owe the state money can know that.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair, we've talked, you're right, we've talked about this several times.
And I don't know the solution.
And I don't know the solution either. One of the things that you and I talked privately about is that we are in the midst of doing a pilot, or we're going to launch a pilot on public notification of delinquent debtors.
Yeah.
We've chatted with other states. Some states think that this is the best thing since sliced bread. Other states say, no, it's more work than it's worth.
Yeah.
We can't identify a single dollar that we've gotten that we wouldn't have gotten anyway through this. And so we're planning on doing a pilot. Our AGs have told us that we have statutory authority to do it. And so we're going to do an administrative rule that outlines the exact parameters of what we might publish for that, both for business debt and for individual debt. And we'll see. We'll see if that makes a difference for us. If it makes a difference for us, great, then that's an additional tool.
Right.
And if not, then we'll move on to something else. I don't mind trying something that fails, because
we
try. Right? That's,
no, that's this what is this is a good, healthy conversation for us to have. So we have 25 minutes left.
I
want to make sure we utilize your time correctly.
I'm very close to the end, actually. I think we'll get done a little bit early.
What?
I'll catch you follow.
These are the major things that we're going to be talking about to you over the course of the week. The core system replacement, you are well aware of. We're in year two of a four-year project to replace our systems, and we're going to need approval from you to continue funding for the project. Funding approval to continue on the project. And the key message for me in this goes to the enormity of the project for us over the last couple of years. The last year, we successfully converted corporation excise tax, cigarette tax, and other tobacco products tax. And We did very well on that, but it consumed nearly all of our discretionary resource. We spent somewhere north of 120,000 hours in person time in converting these. Over the next year, actually over the next 2 years, we'll be, if you approve the funding for it, we will be converting the personal income tax and the withholding tax. The personal income tax is the largest tax we have in terms of accounts. The withholding is where the largest amount of dollars come through. And so we only thought it was a stretch for us to do those three programs, the cigarette corporation and tobacco. We're going to be all in over the next biennium on this. And so I just wanted to let you know that this is a big deal for us. And this last biennium, we had agreed to take on the policy option package, the enforcement policy option package, where you gave us the $3.8 million and we promised you the 33.1. We're not going to be in a position to be able to do that this time around, because the very people that we would need to train those people up are the ones that are going to be doing the testing, the training, and the data cleansing in the new system for those particular programs. And so we need to focus on that, the conversion of those systems successfully over this biennium.
Representative Hurd.
I'm sorry. This is just how I am. Something just hit me about the thing we were talking about earlier about when someone owes the state money not being able to go out and get private credit, hypothetically. I don't know if that actually works in our benefit, and here's why. When I had an individual who owed me money, owed my company money several years back, I went ahead, I filed the necessary paperwork, went to court, won, but he didn't have any money to give me at that point. Just so happened 2 years ago, when he wanted to apply for a new home loan, he had to pay me before the private creditor would actually give him credit. So it actually might play to our strength to allow them to still have access to that market, because at that point the private market's going to say, no, we're not giving you credit until you actually pay the state. So sorry.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hurd, that's has been the chair's position for
we've talked about
yes,
those,
many
yeah.
discussions. And off the top of my head, I can't identify all of the reasons why it's a challenge for us, but we'll provide that. We've done it several times for the chair. We'll provide that in the responses to you. Okay. The next one is personal income tax refund fraud. Our personal income tax program manager is going to talk to you about a couple of opportunities that you have to enhance our ability to detect and stop fraud, and so I won't steal his thunder on that. On the property valuation system bullet here, our property valuation system is in a very similar place to where our income tax systems were a couple of years ago. We have a lot of homegrown products that we use, a lot of paper, a lot of spreadsheets, and we have one primary guy back at the Department of Revenue that has the expertise to be able to work on those systems. And he's getting close to retirement. And so we're in a very similar place to where we were with the income tax systems a couple of years ago. There are computer-assisted mass appraisal, CAMA, systems out there that are commercial off-the-shelf system. All 36 counties have them, and they use it to do their evaluation, and we'll be proposing to you that the Department of Revenue take this up as well. We have a shortfall in our county assessment function funding assistance account, and our property tax administrator will talk to you about that on Thursday. We're going to be asking for some administrative help on our property tax deferral, our senior deferral. Property tax deferral for disabled and senior citizens. I should have just read it. Mm-hmm. Over the past 4 years, there's been significant changes in that program. In fact, the legislature saved it really from insolvency, from going under completely. But you've added several different requirements, including a requirement that each of the participants recertify every couple of years. And the workload is pretty significant on that. So we're going to be asking for some help on that. The implementation of the revised 911 program, you made some changes this last biennium to prepaid wireless and made that a point of sale. We have authority for the dollars, but we need positional authority for an auditor and a processor to be able to implement that, and so we'll be queuing that up for you. And then lastly, that personal income tax rebate is just up there without a package number, because we're not asking for any dollars for this. I've been asked several times how much it would cost us if there's a personal income tax kicker. And the reason that's up there is because it won't cost us anything. It's been moved from a check, which cost us about $1 million to administer last time we had a kicker, to a credit on the return, on the personal income tax return. So it will cost us zero. And then the last thing, these are just...
Can we go back just really quick? Yeah, and I guess I should know this, but I don't. So on the personal income tax rebate, we're looking at offering a credit on a future tax year. Is that...
Yes, Mr. Chair. It would be the 2015 return, which was filed in 2016.
Right
now, if there is, or under prior law, people would be expecting a check that comes in the mail in December of 2015. Instead, it's a credit, and this is the way it was prior to 1995.
Interesting.
We changed it in 95 to a check, ironically, because I remember I was in the income tax programs, and I helped testify on that back in 95.
So will there be a notification to Oregonians that they'll be receiving a credit?
Yes.
Rather than a...
Yes.
Because I think the average guy on the street thinks, average gal on the street thinks she's getting a check.
We've actually gotten several phone calls already about it, yeah, even though the biennium isn't even over yet. But yes, we are letting people know on the website as best as possible.
Got it. Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm.
And then lastly,
Senator Whitsitt.
Just so I have it clear in my mind, thank you. The kicker refund would be a result of excess income tax collections for the current biennium, which ends in June 30th. But the refund would not then occur until April 15th of the next year, which is almost 9 months later. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, that's correct.
Thank you. That does create interesting budget problems, doesn't it?
Yeah. Can I ask a follow-up question? And if you're the wrong person, just let us... Will interest be paid on that credit, knowing that the states had access to those excess dollars for 9 months?
Mr. Chair...
How does that work?
I don't know everything that goes into the personal income tax kicker. I do know that there's a corporate kicker, or the corporate excess over the forecast is
right.
Treated separately, and that is just corporate excise tax revenues. Personal income tax, we call it a personal income tax kicker, but it's really everything else. And so it may very well include a certain portion of interest that was expected to be collected and may have...
referring to is... This is, the state will have access to that kicker rebate for 9 additional months. Rather than issuing the check out immediately, it's going to be held for 9 months. I wonder if that Oregonian will receive interest on their...
That's a different question.
On their rebate, because the state will have access and be able to utilize, however they choose to, they'll be able to utilize those dollars for 9 months until they... extend that out in a credit.
Mr. Chair, it does not include interest.
Does not.
In that regard.
Okay,
no.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, that's one of the primary reasons I voted against that bill, because of the states using our money for another 9 months free. The other thing that really bothers me, and this is just a little off the point, but I mean, that refund comes so late in the biennium that it generally the money isn't addressed in this biennium. We subtract it from the next biennium.
Right.
And so we finance it moving forward and then subtract it from the next biennium, which sort of has a double effect.
Yeah. Well, the big the big dogs, the big co-chairs, mm-hmm. will have an issue to discuss. Okay, let's continue.
This is the last slide in my presentation for today, and I just wanted to cue up that you're going to hear a lot about the accounts receivable on Wednesday of this week, and I just, that bullet there on county funding is just to keep it in your forefront that the Southwest counties in particular are right. still struggling with that federal forest funding issue that they've got. And the reason why this is important for the Department of Revenue is the Department of Revenue is statutorily required to come in and do the county's work for them in the property tax program if the county can't do it themselves. And so I raise this every year just to keep it in your forefront. We're not looking at it happening, but if it happens, we'll probably be back to ask for additional resource, because if more than one small county finds itself in this situation, we'll quickly become overwhelmed at the Department of Revenue and unable to deliver on that.
That's a good reminder for us. All right, any questions for the director? I think you're wrapped up.
I'm wrapped up.
All right. John, what do we need to be thinking about? Are we good? We're on track again. Any other questions? Julie, we good? All right. We're going to adjourn for the day. All right. Adjourn for the day.